So I'm just going to say a couple of words about the method. And the method I'm using is reading through Talmudic and Agadic readings, which means that I'll be using some, there's two source sheets. I'm not sure if there's enough for everybody here, or at least there's enough of the main sheet, which is using simply the text of Megillat Esther, the Book of Esther. And I'll be using that as the main text, but I'll be reading it through the eyes of the Midrash, of Chazal, of the Talmud. Now that means that they're reading, they're reading in ways which are trying to reveal things which aren't necessarily overtly evident in the text. They're trying to show things which, so to speak, they know and others don't know. Now they're reading into the words. So when, for example, someone says, I'll tell you what really happened, they're either giving us inside information, which they are privy to, or they're doing a certain reading, which is an imaginative one, which may be evident to others or not. We'll see. Allow everybody can decide for themselves. And what I'm doing is a certain reading of the story of Esther is a story of a type of trauma. It's a trauma which also mirrors a type of national trauma. Remember the period we're talking about, the period which the Jews are in exile in the kingdom of Persia. They've been to a certain extent rejected by God. They've been exiled from the land. Now for us it's quite clear, we all believe, that the fact that we were thrown out of the land of Israel doesn't mean that God's rejected us. But in those times it wasn't so evident. And we find in the Bible itself, in the book of Ezekiel and other books, saying that the people believed, okay, we've been thrown out of the land, that means our covenant with God has been disregarded, God has rejected us, and we can basically assimilate amongst the nations around. There was that danger, and the prophets were warning against it. They'd gone through the trauma of exile, of destruction, etc. And they were basically assimilating in the land of Persia. Persia was quite a benign kingdom. We have evidence from certain documents from Xerxes, who some identified with Ahasuerus, that actually he gave out decrees that every nation can rule its own land, can be in charge of themselves, freedom of religion. It seems even he was against slavery. He was quite a benign king. So let's look at the story of being taken of the book of Esther, and we'll start reading a little bit from chapter 4. I'll read in the, shall I read the Hebrew or the King James Bible version, or Jerusalem Bible? On one sheet there's two sides. Okay. So, it said, unfortunately, the left column is the first one and the right column is the second one. And it says, there was a Jewish person, man, in the town of Shushan. His name was Mordechai ben Yair ben Shimi ben Kish, from the tribe of Binyamin. Rachel has just given a wonderful class about the tribe of Binyamin. We won't go into that now. And then it says in verse 7, and he brought up Hadassah, that is Esther, his uncle's daughter, for she had neither father nor mother, and the girl was fair and beautiful. And when her father and mother were dead, Mordechai took her for his own daughter. And so it came to pass, when the king's commandment and his decree were heard, and when many young girls were gathered together to Shushan, the capital, to the custody of Haggai, that Esther was brought also to the king's house, to the custody of Haggai, keeper of the women. And the girl pleased him, and she obtained kindness of him. And he speedily gave her her ointments, and her portioned rations, and the 7 maids chosen to give her, out of the king's house. And he advanced her and her maids to the best place in the house of the women. Esther had not made known her people nor her descent, for Mordechai had charged her that she should not tell. And Mordechai walked every day before the court of the women's house to know how Esther did, and what should become of her. And when every girl's turn was to come to King Ahasuerus, after she had been 12 months under the regulations of women, for so were the days of their anointing, namely 6 months with oil of myrrh, 6 months with sweet odors, and with other ointments of women. It's quite a rigorous beauty training. This is how the girl would come to the king. Whatever she desired would be given to her to take with her out of the house of the women into the king's house. In the evening she would go, and in the morning she would return to the second house of the women. We know what happened in between, Chazal said, to the custody of Shashgaz, the king's chamberlain, who kept the concubines. She would come into the king no more unless the king delighted in her, and she were called by name. And when the turn of Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordechai, who had taken her for his daughter, was to come to the king, she requested nothing but what Haggai, the king's chamberlain, the keeper of the women, appointed. And Esther obtained favor in the sight of all those who looked upon her. So Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus into his royal house in the 10th month, which is the month of Tevet. And the king loved Esther more than all the women. She obtained grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins. So he set the royal crown upon her head and made her queen instead of Vashti, etc. This is a basic description of how Esther becomes the queen, becomes the king's wife. There's a certain word which repeats itself various times, which in the Hebrew is even more evident. It's repeated 3 or 4 times. In verse 7, and it says, when Esther's father and mother died, Lekacha Mordechai lo levat. He took her as a daughter. And then the next verse, when the king's decree was found out that the maidens should be taken, Vatilakach Esther Beit HaMelech. She was taken to the house of the king. And again, she finds favor there. And further on, in verse 9, when her time came, again, verse 15, Vatilakach Esther HaMelech Ahasuerus. Again, she was taken to the house of Ahasuerus. So again and again and again, we have this verb, she was taken, she was taken, she was taken, she was taken. Esther is entirely passive. She has no agency in what's happening to her. She is simply taken. Her father and mother died, and according to the Midrash, they died when she was born, or rather her father died before she was born. Her mother died at birth. And Mordechai, her cousin, takes her into his house. And what does he take her as?
Daughter.
A daughter. As a daughter. Now, I see someone smiling there. Someone has already read the Midrash. But we'll leave it for the moment as being taken as a daughter. And she's brought up by him. Note, by the way, that she has a double name. Hadassah hi Esther. We don't find many examples in the Bible of someone growing up with two names. We do have people who start with one name and give another a name. Yaakov is later called Yisrael. Avram is changed to Avraham. We have Daniel's name being changed. But a person growing up with two names is quite an oddity. Her name is Hadassah and Esther. Hadassah is a Jewish name, right? Esther is definitely a Persian name. The Talmud says Esther is the same word as Ishtar. It's a Persian goddess. Quite funny bringing up a Jewish maidler being called, virgin or Ishtar, yes? It's not uncommon, but it's rather strange. She's growing up with two names. One wonders what's her true identity. Is she really Esther and others call her Hadassah, or is she really Hadassah and called Esther? If you notice on the other sheet, those of you who have it can look at it. Otherwise, I'll read it around anyway. It says at the top in handwriting book of Esther. And he brought up Hadassah. She is called Hadassah and she is called Esther. It has been taught Esther was a proper name. Why then was she called Hadassah? After the designation of the righteous who called martyrs, Hadassim. Rabbi Judah says Hadassah was a name. Why then was she called Esther? Because she concealed, masteret, the facts about herself. As it said, Esther did not make known her people or her kindred. Rabbi Nechemiah says Hadassah was a name. Why was she called Esther? All the people called her so after Ishtahar. And then Ben Azai said, we'll just read this last line, Esther was neither too tall nor too short, but of medium size, like a martel. Rabbi Shua ben Kocha said Esther was sallow, the word in Hebrew is yirak roket, but endowed with great charm. Now, this, the Midrash is saying, what's her real name, who she is? And one of the pins is saying, she calls herself Esther, she's called Esther because she's hiding herself. Why does she have to hide herself? And we note that her uncle tells her, don't reveal to anyone your true identity. Keep it a secret. No one is to know who you really are. Pardon me? Her cousin. Thank you. No one is to know who you really are. Keep it a secret. We have someone who's probably a child, a young girl, maybe in her teens, and she's being told to keep it quite a secret who she really is. No one is to really know. So we have someone who's growing up here with secrets. We'll find out soon there's more secrets going on. And she's taken again to the king's house. And when she's there, she finds grace and favor in everybody's eyes. Now, there's a funny midrash here which said, we just read the last line, she wasn't actually even good looking at all. She had great charm. It's funny, you know, we imagine we have this beauty contest going on. How is one to win in a beauty contest when you have so many beautiful women all around you? I remember when I was a child in school, we had this little poems which we read towards Purim that the King Ahasuerus is saying, I've looked at girls, so many girls with red and black and golden hair. So he's looked at all these beautiful women from all of the kingdom. Why Dafka Esther? We all know that it's got to be something extra, because you can't really compare beauty after you've seen 1,000 beautiful women. So there's something special going on. Therefore, one of these opinions is saying, well, actually, she wasn't really good looking at all. She had special grace. I'd just like to imagine for a second what Esther must have been going through taking into the king's palace. You have someone who's brought up probably in a quite secluded or certainly protected environment, as women usually were in those times. And suddenly she's thrown into a harem and she becomes a number. There's a certain term in Israel called helem bakum. Now helem means shock. Bakum means the place where one joins the army. You know, every soldier is going to the army. They go into this place called bakum, which is an acronym of can't remember what. And they're given a number, they're given their clothes, they're given the same uniform, they all go through the same training, etc., etc. And gradually, they become, in one way or another, shell-shocked. Now, I'm exaggerating grossly when I say shell-shocked. When I went into the army, I went in, and I wasn't taking things too tensely. You know, my feeling was always, okay, if they tell me to run, I'll run, have to run again, three times, who cares, you know. I remember once, it was a Shabbos, possibly about a month after I was into the army, and I want to tell you, I went in, I wasn't 18, I was already in my early 20s, and when all the soldiers used to really be pressured, we have to get things done, I'd be saying, okay, fine, you know, don't worry, take your time, yes. I was sitting at home, we had a Shabbos off, I was sitting, you know, in shul reading the parasha, and suddenly I woke up, and I hadn't been asleep, but I suddenly clicked out of it, and I realized that the past weeks had gone on in a type of daze which I hadn't even been aware of being in the daze. No one else external would have seen me as in a daze, but there's something which changes in a person's mind where they're made into a number, and gradually one comes out of it one way or another. Don't worry, most of the soldiers come out of it sooner or later. It's only the ones who don't become generals. I shouldn't have said that, should I? And Esther is taken to the king's house. She becomes a number. She becomes dazed. But all the other girls are asking for what they want. Look at Esther. She doesn't ask for anything. She has no personal desires. Yes? It says anything a girl would ask for would be given for her. But Esther did not ask for anything. Just what her promotion person, Hegai, would say to her, that's what she'd wear. She has no personal desires. I think this is suspect. I think this is quite worrisome, that she doesn't have any personal inclinations. What she want to wear? Whatever you say. This is a girl who's saying yes. Yes, whatever you do, she's a puppet here. And again, she's taken and taken. And in line 9, it says that she found favor in the eyes of everybody who saw her. Everybody finds her wonderful. Again, I think this is quite worrying. I don't think I would like to find favor in everybody's eyes. I think it would be quite worrisome if I did. It would mean I've become some type of blank yes-sayer who everybody can like. It means rather being rather characterless. I find this problematic, deeply problematic, that Esther's finding favor in everybody's eyes. I want to read a little bit more on the sheet with the Midrashim on it, which come mainly from the Talmud. And then the second line, for she had neither father nor mother. And it continues, and when her father and mother died, why these last words? Rabbi Abba said, when her mother became pregnant, her father died. When she was born, her mother died. So she doesn't have any identity given by her parents either. The only identity she knows was not from her mother, was not from her father, was simply from this cousin who seems to be raising her. And when her father and mother died, Mordechai took her for his own daughter. It's very kind of Mordechai, right? Atana taught in the name of Meir, read not for a daughter, but bayit, house. Is also an Aramaic term. The word for a wife in Aramaic is the bitu. Similarly, it says, but the poor man had nothing except for a ewe lamb, etc., etc. I'm jumping the italics. Because it lay in his bosom, was it Lord? Rather, it means that is a wife. So here it means a wife. So now Rabbi Meir is telling us a secret. He's telling us everybody thinks that Esther is Mordechai's adopted daughter, cousin, he's raising her. Actually, I'll tell you what was really going on there. He lived with her as a wife. And it's rather a suspicious thing because Rabbi Meir is saying no one else knows about it. Mordechai is raising her as ostensibly a daughter, but Rabbi Meir is saying, you know, actually, I'll tell you what's really going on. He was actually cohabiting with her. He was living with her as a wife. I think this is a little bit problematic. But we'll see it gets even more problematic further on. Because after the king has decreed this edict that all the maidens should be taken to Shushan, and it probably didn't need too much coercion. After all, you have the possibility of even being in the king's harem. It's quite a good position. And Mordechai is sending his cousin also for this competition. Many commentators say that Mordechai, because sitting in the king's gate didn't mean he was a beggar there. It means he was one of the judges, one of the ministers, and therefore there was this competition between him and Haman. I'm not going to be talking too much about Haman. In fact, we won't be talking at all about Haman today, but Mordechai a little bit more. She could forward his cause. She could bring us forward, as she actually does when she reveals in his name, of course in his name, the plot against the king's life. But Mordechai is saying to her, don't tell anyone your identity. Keep silent. You're not supposed to tell anybody where you come from, what nation you come from. You're not supposed to tell anybody, of course, the relationship between us. That could spoil everything. Esther is sworn to secrecy. And just to say a word or two about trauma, sometimes what can be more problematic in trauma than the trauma itself is the denial of the trauma, is the response to it afterwards. Sometimes when someone goes through trauma, and these things are healable, we will see how Esther does heal her own trauma, but the denial of it is even worse. When someone, God forbid, goes through, for example, rape, so the worst thing that parents can do is say, it's okay, don't worry. No, it needs to be related to. Sometimes the repression of the trauma is what causes post-traumatic syndrome, the denial of it. Esther's being told to be quiet. Another point, it can be so awfully, awfully confusing for a child. Every child desires love. To be given sex instead of love, or rather be given sex and told this is love, is so confusing, is so traumatic. The child doesn't know what's what. Its identity is eradicated because they have no gauge of what is real, of what is real love and what isn't real love. They have no ability to choose. And I suspect that Mordechai is manipulating her in many ways. I just want to say one more thing. Let's read a little bit of the text, the Midrash here. And the seven maidens who were meet to be given to her. She was given, again, every maiden was given seven maidens. She was given seven maidens. Rabba said they were seven so that she could count the days of the week by them. There's a funny reading. I mean, seven maidens, you know. Rabba's describing in a way that she loses all sense of time. Why does she need seven maidens? You know, most of us can manage Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. He's saying in a way she's lost sense of time. She's completely lost all identity and sense of time in the king's palace, so that she needs these people to count the days by, meaning say more about her than her needs for seven maidens. And then it says, he changed her maidens. Rav said he gave her Jewish food to eat. And then 6 months with oil of myrrh. What is the oil of myrrh? Oil from olives, not to third grown, etc. It removes the hair, makes the skin soft. She's been given the works. There's a certain treatment which everyone's treated to. In the evening she went and on the morrow she returned. From the discreditable account of that wicked man, Ahasuerus, we can learn something of his credit. Namely, he did not perform his marital office by the day. This is one good thing to say about him. He reserved his practices with the maidens at the nighttime. Small comfort. And Esther obtained favor. Elazar said, this informed us that every man took her for a member of his own people. Another Midrash says, the Persians thought she's a Persian, the Medes thought she's a Median, the Babylonians thought she's a Babylonian, meaning, remember the song, I'm every woman, right? She's every woman. Everybody thinks, it's a perfect dream. The Persians think she must be one of ours, the Medians think she's one of ours, meaning she just doesn't have her own character. She's reflecting. She's a blank sheet. She's smiling to everybody. She's nice to everybody. She finds favor in everybody's eyes. But it's a sinister description. Everybody sees her as one of theirs. She's not saying who her nation is. Possibly she's almost forgotten it herself. And then to the just before the bottom, on the left-hand column, and the king loved Esther above all the women, and she obtained grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins. There's a double language here. Why all the women and all the virgins? And so the Midrash says, Rav said, if he wanted to find in her a taste of a virgin, he found it. If a taste of a married woman, he found it. Every man's dream, right? You know, he wants an experienced woman, that was Esther. He wants someone to feel she's a virgin, that's Esther. She can be everything he wants. She's not herself. She can be whatever his desires are. It's a very sad picture of what's happened to her. And the bottom of the left-hand side is a little bit hard to read. And when the virgins were gathered together a second time, he went and took counsel of Mordechai, who said, the way to rouse a woman is to make her jealous. Even so, she did not tell. I don't know what would move Mordechai to this cruelty unless he has something to gain from it. You know, the king doesn't manage to discover where she's from. So Mordechai says, you know what, bring another woman. She'll be jealous. Let's see if she's going to really be faithful to me and not tell her nation or not. Mordechai's testing her mettle, even though he's not inside. He's outside. And so the king brings in another beauty competition, and still Esther does not tell where she comes from. She's proving utterly faithful to Mordechai. And the last line of the chapter which we read is line 20. Esther had not yet made known her kindred or her people, as Mordechai had charged her. For Esther carried out the bidding of Mordechai just as when she was brought up with him. In Ivrit, it's Ma'amar Mordechai Esther Osa Kasher Haita Bo'omna Ito. She was completely continuing the same way, obeying Mordechai, not her husband, obeying Mordechai as it was when she lived with him. On the top of the second column, I'll just need Midrash. Like as when she was brought up with him, Rabba ben Lema said, Nirav, this means she used to rise from the lap of Ahasuerus and bathe and sit in the lap of Mordechai. Obviously, this is a completely phantasmagoric picture. I don't think Esther could slip out at night from the king's harem and go to town and say, I'm just going out for a few hours, I'll come back. But the Midrash is saying, what does it mean she's continuing just as she was with Mordechai? They're saying she'd get up from Ahasuerus, having relationships with Ahasuerus, go to the mikveh, and go and sleep with Mordechai. Now, this is the actually was my starting point when I started feeling there's something awful going on. I wasn't looking for some nasty story about Mordechai. But when I saw this phrase, I thought, this is terrible, this is awful. Someone living with Ahasuerus, but her former lover or her former husband not allowing her, has such control over her, and she's still basically a child probably in our terms, not allowing her to have forged any bonding or to recognize where she is. You know, you're not in Mordechai's house anymore. You're with Ahasuerus. We've been so programmed to thinking as Jews, oh, well, you know, she's Jewish and, you know, she stayed a Jew. It's a sad story in the end. The fact is that the book of Esther has a happy ending. It's obviously a book with a happy ending. I'm remembering a story, letters children wrote. One of the children says, we've moved into a new house now, and now each of us has our own room except for poor mummy. She still has to share with daddy. So Esther, in this case, hasn't chosen Mordechai as a child, but Mordechai is still so present in her life, she's completely in denial of where she is. Everything is exactly as it was when she was growing up with Mordechai. I think there's a terrible image of someone getting up from Ahasuerus and going to the mikveh, whether or not it's obviously a parable, and going to be with Mordechai. It's a very sinister picture. Any questions so far? Okay. So, I think Esther deeply needs to be needed. But she needs to be needed so much by Mordechai, she can't detach from him. And she's basically set up the system, which is copied unawarely by so many cases of child abuse. When you have, God forbid, parents or uncles or relatives, and most, you know, sexual abuse in families happens in families, and there's this covenant of silence. Don't speak to anyone. Don't tell anyone. It's eradicating the person's personality until sometimes almost miraculously they manage to break out of it. Mordechai has set this up in such a sinister way. But we'll see what happens in the next chapter. Mordechai is, I don't think the Megillah is describing him as a very sagacious, wise, intelligent person. Not at all. I mean, simply for reasons of pride, he doesn't bow down to Haman. What's the problem? You know, Haman has been made a minister. The decree has an edict. Everybody has to bow down to Haman. Okay, you bow down to Haman, you know. Curtsy if you want. Mordechai, I'm not going to bow down. Mordechai was maybe angry that he was passed by. I'm not going to bow down. And he really irks Haman. And Haman decides he's going to kill Mordechai. And after he decides he'll kill all of Mordechai's people. There was no reason for this. There was no need for this. It's simply Mordechai's pride, arrogance, that he's not going to bow down to Haman. There's no good reason for it. He almost brings calamity on the whole people. And suddenly the calamity happens, and really it's getting difficult. And when Mordechai perceived all that was done, Mordechai rent his cloth, put sackcloth to ashes, went out into the midst of the city, cried with a loud and bitter cry, and came even before the king's gate, though none might enter the king's gate with sackcloth. And people were mourning, etc., etc. Verse 4, so Esther's maids and her chamberlains came and told it her. Then the queen was exceedingly distressed, and she sent raiment to cloth Mordechai to take away his sackcloth from him, but he would not accept it. This is really shows the girls living in cloud cuckoo land. Her uncle comes, and instead of wearing the type of clothes you're supposed to wear, he's wearing sackcloth. Now, everybody knows you're not supposed to wear sackcloth when you come to the king's courtyard. So what do you do? Oh, can I send you some clothes? I mean, hey, do you think he doesn't have a spare pair of clothes? Oh, he doesn't have the right clothes. Well, I'll send him a jacket. I'll send him a suit. Hasn't clicked what happened. And Mordechai says to tell Esther what's happened and to tell her, you better put your head in there and get us out of trouble, which is charming of him. You know, basically the troubles have started. Esther, you go and solve things. And so she says to him in verse 10, and Esther spoke to Hatach and gave him a message from Mordechai. All the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that whoever, whether man or woman, shall come to the king into the inner court who is not called, there is one law for him, namely to put him to death, except such to whom the king shall hold out the golden scepter that he may live. But I have not been called to come to the king these 30 days. She says, you know, I've fallen out of grace. For 30 days the king hasn't called me. I don't seem to have such a good standing anymore. You know, what you're telling me to do is basically means death sentence. You're asking me, go and kill yourself so that to get you out of trouble, to get the people out of trouble, a people who she's been estranged from and alienated from for so long. Mordechai is telling her, yes, get yourself killed. Now, what would you expect Mordechai to say? One would expect him possibly to say, yes, but it's the problem here. You're the only one who can solve the problem. There's no one else to turn to. Yes, I've done a terrible thing. Maybe yes, maybe not. No one else can solve this. He answers in quite a different mean. Verse 13. Then Mordechai commanded to answer Esther, commanded, note, do not think in thy heart that thou shalt escape in the king's house any more than all the other Jews. That's rubbish. Of course she'll escape. I mean, Haman may be killing all the Jews. He's not going to kill the king's wife, the queen. Do not think that you're going to escape into the king's house. For if thou dost at all remain silent at this time, then relief shall, deliverance shall arise from the Jews from elsewhere, but thou and thy father's house shall perish. The first time she's getting in touch with her father's house. And who knows whether thou art not come to royal estate for such a time as this? Then Esther bade them return Mordechai this answer. Go, gather together all the Jews who are present in Shushan. Fast for me, neither eat nor drink 3 days, night and day. I also, my maiden, will fast likewise. And so I will go unto the king, though it is against the law. And if I perish, I perish. Kasha avadati avadati. If I get lost, I get lost. So Mordechai went his way and did according to all that Esther had commanded him. And from now on, it's not Mordechai giving the orders, it's Esther giving the orders. And I think that inadvertently, Mordechai managed to activate Esther in a way that he couldn't have done any better than saying his cynical statement, no one needs you. He says to her, listen, if you don't do it, someone else will do it. And I think she suddenly dawns on him who she's been obeying all the time, who she's been subservient to all the time. This person who says, when she says, you know, I could be killed, he says, well, if you don't do it, someone else will do it. You're going to get lost anyway. And then she says, okay, I'm going to take control. This is where she takes her identity. Now, her identity isn't from one day to the next. It takes a few days. It's a gradual thing. It's a beautiful thing, the way it develops, as we'll soon see. But I want to take a little vignette of King Ahasuerus, because I think he's given a hard run by the Talmud. I think a justifiably hard run. I don't have that much sympathy for someone who will say to his vizier, Haman, oh, well, if you want the people, just do whatever you like and keep the money. But on a different level, I imagine Ahasuerus very hurt. He's in his inner courtyard. He hasn't called for 30 days. Imagine at the beginning of the book, we have Ahasuerus, who has the whole of Shushan, the capital, partying in his palace. He has a palace and everybody's invited. In 180 days, he has party for the kingdom, and then another 7 days, his house is open to everybody. And by the time we meet this chapter, he is so closed and ensconced in his inner chambers that no one can come into him except having had an invitation going past all the security. I think there's a double story going on. On the one hand, his life has been threatened. His bodyguards, Shomrei HaMelech, wanted to kill him, and he was just managed to escape through Mordechai's intervention. But on a different level, I'd imagine him, he's done everything to find favor in Esther's eyes. He's loved Esther. He's chosen her. He's given her everything. He's made her the queen. When she asks him for something, his heart leaps out to her. She's not sure of this at all. But his heart leaps out to her. He's been so hurt, both physically and emotionally, that he's retreated into his inner chambers. Esther somehow realized this, and she has to reach away towards his heart. And she does it in a very beautiful way, in a very beautiful scene. But just before that, in the second paragraph of the right-hand column, go gather all the Jews. Rabbi Abba said, it will not be, she said, according to the custom of every other day. Till now I've associated with Ahasuerus under compulsion, but now I will do so of my own will. And if I perish, I perish. As I am lost to my father's house, so shall I be lost to thee. They're interpreting her saying, Ka'asher avadati, avadati, if I'm lost, I'm lost. Not just if I'm dead, I'm dead, but she's saying, I will be lost. She's saying, Mordechai, you know, I will do what you say. I will do it. But up till now, I've done it under coercion. Up till now, Midrash says, why was she allowed? And I'm using the halachic aspect of it to portray the meta-halachic, the emotional, the psychological aspect. Up till now, she was, so to speak, allowed to be both with the Ahasuerus and yet go and sleep with Mordechai, halachically, because she was honest, she was forced, she had no choice but to be with Ahasuerus. And therefore, you know, got no way, I've got to be with Ahasuerus, but I'm really your wife. She says to me, you know what, I will go to Ahasuerus, but from now on I'm doing it by choice. I can't sham this, I can't pretend to go to Ahasuerus. I am choosing to be Ahasuerus' wife. And therefore, I will be lost to you, Mordechai. I'm not your wife anymore. She's giving him his get. I think this place where she's taking agency in her life and saying, right, this is it, Mordechai. I'm doing it, but I'm choosing Ahasuerus. I think she's chosen the better man. I think she's decided to... I really think she's chosen the better man. I'm not saying Ahasuerus is that savourier character, but I think Mordechai isn't that savourier character either. And by the way, the Midrash in the end of Megillat Esther says that many of the Sanhedrin didn't like Mordechai either. So, I mean, I'm in good company, yes? She's saying, I will be lost to you, Mordechai, that's it. And that is such a meaningful decision, realizing I'm not trying to kowtow to Mordechai, I'm not trying to find favor in his eyes. And now she goes into the king, and it's such a beautiful scene, that I'll read the Tanakh, but then the Megillat Esther, but then I'll read the words of the Midrash, which just embellish it so beautifully. And it was on the third day. Now it came to pass on the third day, the beginning of chapter 5. that Esther put on her royal apparel, stood in the inner court of the king's house, over the, against the king's house. And the king sat upon his royal throne in the royal house opposite the gate. And so it was, when the king saw Esther, the queen, standing in the court, she obtained favor in his sight. And the king held out to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand. I'm not sure what Freud would make out of the golden scepter, but I know what the Midrash says. We'll see it in a moment. Then the king said to her, "What is thy wish, Queen Esther? What is thy request? It shall be given thee, even unto half the kingdom." And Esther answered, "If it seem good to the king, let the king and Haman..." And the rest is known, right? Now, the Midrash puts it beautifully. I see some people smiling, they already know the Midrash. "And stood in the inner court of the king's house, Rabbi Levi said, when she reached the chamber of the idols..." And they're putting words into her mouth. Obviously, they didn't have a tape recorder recording her. But they're putting these words into her mouth describing something. The divine presence left her. You can call it divine presence. You can call it Shekhinah. You can call it one's self of, sense of self, one's maybe charisma, as you were using the word beforehand. She said, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Eli, Eli, lama azavtani. For those of you who didn't know, it wasn't, these words weren't first pronounced in the year 40. Dost thou perchance punish the inadvertent offense like the presumptuous one, or one undone under the compulsion like as one done willingly? And I was, I don't really want to do this. But then it continues. Or is it because I called him a dog, as it said, deliver my soul from the sword, my only one from the power of the dog? All these verses in the same Psalm 22. She straightway retracted and called him a lion, as it says, saving from the lion's mouth. At first he's trying to say to God, God, I don't really want to do this, but that's not washing. It doesn't work. It doesn't bring her back Shekhinah. She says, maybe it's because I've related to him as a dog. And obviously, up till now, she couldn't really relate to Ahasuerus as anything but a dog, as anything but a lowly creature who has abducted her, who has taken her and taken her into his house perforce. And therefore, she's regarding him as this low creature who she has to cohabit with. And now she's suddenly realizing, maybe she's for the first time seeing Ahasuerus in his humanity, in his vulnerability, in his need for her. And she turns around and she says, actually, he's a lion. And she recognizes him and she goes towards him willingly. The only way she really can do anything here is not to play role, is to really be this person, to change herself. And she goes towards him, and when he saw the Esther the queen, Rabbi Yochanan said, three ministering angels were appointed to help at that moment. One to make her head erect, a second to endow with charm, a third to stretch out the golden scepter. How much was it stretched? Rabbi Jeremiah said it was 2 cubits long. He made it 12 cubits. Some say 16, some say 24. In the Brit it says 60. Say no more. Yes. In other words, to put it in very simple terms, he was enormously sexually aroused because suddenly she. This is someone who, you know, has a whole harem of women, but he's suddenly aroused because she's attracted to him. She is now not just suffering him, she's attracted to him. She's choosing him. Yes? Ahasuerus himself, the next night, has these dreams of people possibly wanting to help hurt him. And he goes to the story with Mordechai. And I'll just say this as an aside, because, you know, what do you do when a child has nightmares? You tell them frightening stories. Yes, if a child is not sleeping at night, you tell them Brother Grimm stories. Why Brother Grimm stories? Because it turns out you're right in being afraid. When a person doesn't sleep well at night, it's often because of their bad conscience. Ahasuerus has his bad conscience. After he himself feels loved by the woman he loves, by Esther, he can finally meet his bad conscience, and he doesn't sleep easily. He may not even be so aware that he's signed an edict against the whole people, but he realizes, I'm the murderer. And then he's told of this story of Mordechai saving him from being murdered, which is a reflection of his own murderousness. Suddenly he arouses. Once he is touched, he also becomes more human. He also becomes more of what he can be. We have to finish, and I do want to leave a little bit of time for questions. But just in the last section, it's a little bit rubbed out, but I'll read it. The king Ahasuerus says to Esther, why did... He said again. First he spoke to her through intermediary. When he told her that she came from the house of Saul, he spoke to her directly. In other words, Now she's attained her identity. Rather than saying, I have no identity, she's saying, I come from the house of Saul. I have an identity. I have a father, I have a mother. My identity isn't one which was imposed upon me by Mordechai. My identity is the one which I choose. A lot of trauma healing is about a person, and all healing, and Shuva in general, is about a person accepting who they are. Rather, to put it perhaps more precisely, a person choosing to be that which they cannot not be. If a person has problems around their about their height, they can't solve it by wearing tall heels. If a person has problems about their sexuality, they can't necessarily solve it by pretending it's not that. Some of the healing, it's a hard process, is choosing to be who one is. Esther has been denying that she is actually Ahasuerus' wife. Her healing is when she accepts, this is who I am. I'm not someone else. I am this person. And there's a mirror here of what happened to the Jewish people in that whole period. Because you have a nation which was basically trying to assimilate, was managing to assimilate in a very benign empire. Until suddenly Haman comes along and imposes upon them their Jewish identity, killing them for no other reason that they're Jewish. And their healing, their tshuva, their accepting Torah anew, is accepting that, yes, this is who we are. We are that which we cannot be other than. In other words, it's not something which one can choose. To a very great extent, one's identity is not something which one can choose. One's choice is to choose to be who one is, or as Nietzsche would put it, to become that which you are. And I think that's what Esther, to a great extent, is a beautiful story of tshuva. It's a beautiful story of tshuva which isn't just about change, but it's about choice. It's about choosing who one really is. That's for that reason we have such motives about Purim, about inebriation, in the hope that one sees who one really is and is able to choose that from a point of freedom. And from then on, when Esther really chooses to be who she is, she's also free to love. She's able, I think, to be Ahasuerus' wife. The end of the Megillah has Esther living with Ahasuerus, and that is a happy ending. Anyone who doesn't read it as a happy ending, I don't think he's reading the Pshat in Megillah. It hasn't a sad ending that she remains there. It's a happy ending. It's a type of they all lived happily ever after ending. Esther in charge of everything. Mordechai is the puppet, but basically from then on he's doing what she tells him to do, which is quite a healing of the trauma with which she grew up. And if there's any questions, I think we have a few moments for them. Yes. Thank you. I hope I've shown a little bit that it's already the Talmud is reading it that way. I think they were noticing things. True. But it is, after all, it is called the Book of Esther, thank God, rather than the Book of Mordechai. She definitely deserves my vote. Yes? think so. And I think that it's a further tragedy of diaspora if one doesn't recognize that one is in diaspora. I think that, thank God, in recent years, 10, 15, maybe more years, rather than this image which was always propounded by the Sochnut or by the JNF or whoever it was, that there's only one real Israel and everybody else is sort of planet circuiting around, but there's only one true Judaism, I think that thankfully there's been more and more realization that there's various centers of Judaism. I think that's a place, not just for healing, but for growth. As long as one sees oneself as an illegitimate existence, you know, I should be in Israel, but I'm here, you know, it's denying one's choice to be where one is. I think Esther, at some stage, or the people there, realized, no, we are Jews living here, but we have our identity. Now, that was, by the way, the case all through the generations, that the center of Jews in Babel, which was a continuation of the one in Persia, had a very proud identity as Babylonian Jews. And I think that once one recognized, this is who I am, this is my real choice, one can also grow as a diaspora, rather than being something which in some state of denial. In other words, maybe diaspora was caused by some type of trauma, but that's not the sense that most people are feeling. One has to recognize, this is who I am. In a way, there's an aspect of the Megillah which is one of assimilation, but obviously it's not assimilation because it's left in our books, but it's less to recognize, and this is my choice, and it's a choice from which there's a happy end and a happy start. The Midrash
is a tragedy because there aren't next generation.
We don't know, right. Rachel?
Yeah.
The tradition says her son was the one who gave the edict that the Jews can go to Israel. Last question? Oh, that's second last. You've given me a great idea. You know, in our synagogue in Israel, Yakar, so we're going to have a women's reading of Megillah. I mean, that's done in many centers in Israel. We're going to have one in our place. I don't know if men are allowed to enter, but anyway, it's women doing Megillah. And maybe it would be a good idea, seeing as there's no obligation whatsoever for the community to read certain verses aloud, it's a custom, maybe it would be a good idea if women's minyanim were to dafka read other verses aloud, the verses extolling Esther. Could be far more, I mean, yes, the book does seem to be a little bit sycophantic towards Mordechai, but maybe that's a good idea rather than the ones which are extolling Mordechai. I mean, the only thing we see him doing at the end of the book is putting taxes on the country, or the king does. I don't know what other good things he's doing. If that's good, well, it matters which side of the coin you're on. I like what you're saying. Last question? I don't think one knows who wrote it. Yes, possibly together. But maybe there's something quite unmasculine, in a positive way, in the fact that the ceremonies of Purim are mishloch manot ish li-re'ehu, sending gifts to each other. It's not a type of festival which one celebrates with sacrifices or ceremonies, but rather a very family type of festival, and matanot le'avyonim. Maybe a feasting, a type of center, rather than a synagogue center of this festival. But I don't know if one knows who wrote it. And it seems to be both of them together. I mean, let's face it, in those times, women didn't have that much power and agency as they do have nowadays. So if she got to, you know, part, to write half of it, it's also pretty good, I guess.
Did she write it all
herself? I don't know. Now, I just want to say one last comment, just to mitigate Mordechai. I want to say one last thing, and this is really a last word. Forgive me. Well, I'll take the question afterwards. What I've done is in a certain way, is a modern reading. But let's remember that not that long ago, it was quite common for people to marry their cousins. It could sometimes be the kindest thing that someone took into their house, someone who was an orphan, and took them into their house and married them. It was common. In other words, me reading this in this way is a certain type of reading, but to be fair, it's possible to read it otherwise, especially because this was common in many cultures, that one did take in one's orphaned relatives and marry them. And there was nothing wrong with a person marrying an orphaned relative, even if she was 12 years old or something else. It was some of the best thing which could be. I think it's important to remember, I don't know if trauma existed 1,000 years ago. Yes, I know I'm being an apicorus towards psychology now, but I don't know if trauma existed. It's a modern term which one needs to be suspicious of any terms in any culture, whether it's philosophical or psychological. We all are sure that, yes, there's such a thing as trauma. Maybe it's not to be taken so simply. And maybe Mordechai was doing what was the best thing and the done thing in those times. I'll let each of you judge it your own way. Thank you very much.